Our lives don't get better by chance. They get better by change. Change is one of the necessary laws of life. Remember this: action and adaptability create opportunity. Adapt and overcome, and watch everything change before your eyes. Adaptability isn't just some secret for survival. It is the power to build the future. Adaptability is the capacity to be modified for a new purpose, to be moved this way and still punch through targets and reach my goals and be everything I've been called to be, but I've got to adapt to the times. Adaptability requires movement. Adaptability requires growth. Adaptability requires wisdom and knowledge and understanding and revelation and awareness. We've got to be able to recognize when we're outdated, when we need an upgrade, when we've got to go to that next level, and I can't be embarrassed about it. Adaptability is not buckling under pressure. Adaptability is understanding that in order for me to have this lifestyle that I see in my head, I'm going to have to raise my standards. This is an adjustment. This is a modification that in times past, this version of me was good enough, but it only got me where I am. And in order for me to go to that next level, something inside of me has to change. So when you face storm, when you face adversity, when you face trial, when you face tribulation, in the eye of the storm, in the middle, in the core of your devastation, when you are faced with opposition, that's when you raise the heat. You don't change your message, you change your methodology. Are you understanding me? Adaptability is not buckling under pressure. Adaptability is not losing your moral compass. Adaptability is raising your voice. And so the harder life hits me, the harder I'm going to fight, the harder I'm going to believe, the harder I'm going to keep pushing, I'm going to keep going, I will persevere, and I'm going to build resilience. And so the harder life hits, the stronger I get. You've got problem-solving skill, you've got a resilience, you have a determination, you have a measure of commitment that nobody in the room has because you've been able to adapt. And for many of us, we are in the halftime of our destiny, and if you're going to win, you are going to have to make the adjustments, the necessary modifications to have your future. When I become more flexible, more agile, more adaptable, another thing that happens is that we build our inner resilience. And this isn't just about honing in on your problem-solving skills, but resilience literally changes your brain. It changes your operating systems. It shifts your behavior. Resilience empowers you to build new habits. It's not running from your programming. It's upgrading. It's taking it to the next level. The necessary growth strategies, necessary modification, personality adjustment, attitude upgrades, the necessary, the wise adapt themselves to the circumstances, like water molds itself to the pitcher. To understand the revelation of adaptability is to realize that life is lived on levels. I've got angles, I've got approaches, that destiny is in the details. It's how I see this thing. It's how I can adjust my thinking. It's how I can upgrade my inner software. At some point, you gotta sit back and think to yourself, you know what? I've been here too long. I've thought like this too long. I've hurt too long. I've been fractured long enough. I've been depressed long enough. You know what? I've been here too long. It's time for me to go. We all have to get here where we realize we have not adapted to the current times. And this is not a departure from authenticity. This is not losing yourself. This is finding your next level. The question is, are you willing to adapt? Adaptability is the bridge to the future. I need to be able to adapt cognitively. I gotta be able to adapt emotionally. My personality, my behavior, my language, my thinking. I've got to be able to adapt. And it is only when I'm willing
to accept this reality.
You look at Cuomo and all those guys, they were born rich kids, their father.
Right.
Now, Trump could have taken that path too. He was born a rich kid. So it's not, I think you're either an entrepreneur or you're not. So what happens to entrepreneurs who go out and they get their handed to them and they survive? If you survive, you see the world differently. And so that's what happened to you when you get injured and all this.
Yeah.
You see a different world. Whereas peacetime, who's climbing the corporate ladder right now, they just lost their job. They're sucking their thumb. The rich dad, poor dad is the story of my rich dad who had no education, but he grew up in business for real. You know, he took over the family business at 13. So he kind of grew up in the real world of money. Where my rich dad was a PhD, poor, helpless, and desperate. Went to Stanford, Northwestern, you know, very smart guy, good guy and all this. But as you know, teachers don't know. They teach stuff they don't know nothing about.
Right. Well, some of them are forced. They're forced to teach that, right? Some of them try to educate in other ways and inspire.
Don't defend them. I don't like them. Anyway, you know what happens? When do I get in the most trouble? Is when I criticize going to school. Because to many people, it's their only hope and salvation.
Yeah.
So if I say, well, I don't think school teaches you much, I may as well piss on the Pope. You know, they said,
I know.
Religion. If you don't go to school, and then I tell them, well, you know, Steve Jobs dropped out. He did pretty good.
Yep.
It's dropped out. Dell dropped out.
Zuckerberg
dropped out. Henry Ford. Walt Disney. They didn't hurt.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah.
If you're an entrepreneur right now, the world's open to you. If you're an employee, your world's dead to you. An entrepreneur can create their own success. If I show you this diagram here, you know, it's why I created my cash flow board game.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have four different intelligences. We have mental intelligence. We have, I don't know what that one is, physical intelligence. You probably have very good physical to make, you know, football and all that.
Yeah.
Emotional intelligence, but spiritual intelligence. So I went to military school in New York. The first thing is spiritual. You know, I become a Marine. It's spiritual.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because you're putting your life on the freaking line.
Yeah.
You know, so Nassim Taleb, you know, wrote the book, The Black Swan. He also wrote Anti-Fragile. He says there's three kinds of people in the world. There's fragile, and that's what our school systems are putting out, fragile, wimpy, snowflakes. And that's your choice. You want to be that way? Have a good life.
Mm-hmm.
The second type is that, so a fragile is like a champagne flute.
Yep.
You hit it, it shatters. Then the second one is called robust. And a robust person is like the rock. You know, you can pound on them, dump on them.
Yeah.
They take it. But that's all they do. They take it. And then anti-fragile is somebody like you where they pound the crap out of you and you get smarter and better because of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I love Nassim Taleb. You know, a lot of people call him Dr. Doom. But the way I look at this whole thing, this economy, we're probably going into a depression. You know, we're not going to get out of this.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And so the thing is this good for you or bad for you? I'm looking forward to it. You know, the last crash was 2008, and I made more money in 2008 than in my whole life. I'm now 700 million, almost a billion in debt.
Really?
You know why? Because I don't pay any taxes. The more debt I have, the less tax I pay. And the average guy goes, how do you do that? Because you have bad teachers. And so it's this whole thing that you got to choose your teachers wisely. That's why I wrote the book, Fake Money, Fake Teachers, Fake Assets. I don't touch that garbage of what's out. I don't have a 401k. I don't have stocks, bonds, mutual funds, ETFs. Doesn't mean you shouldn't, but I don't need them. Okay?
Right.
And the other part is, look, for you young guys, the best teachers are not in colleges. The best teachers are on YouTube. The best teachers are on YouTube. Wake up. You know, this guy, George Gammon, he's fantastic. Patrick Bet-David. Fantastic, you know.
He's great.
Jim Rickards. The fake teachers are in colleges. And they're telling you to get a job.
Right.
Up the corporate ladder. You know, Patrick Bet-David said it the best. And I love that guy. He says there's two kinds of leaders, wartime and peacetime. And a peacetime leader is a guy like my poor dad. He goes through all the right schools. He has all the pedigrees and credentials. He does all the right things. He climbs the corporate or the government ladder and all that. Well, a wartime leader goes to war. So Jobs, Steve Jobs, a wartime leader. I'm a wartime leader. Difference is I went to war. You know, I don't know where it is. I got this iPhone. If you can't make money with that, hang it up. You know, like we used to say, hang up the jockstrap. You're not going to make the team. You can't make money with an iPhone through social media, through marketing. You have the world at your fingertips, and you can't make money. The problem is between this year and this year. It's not out here. It's in here.
Lead a happy life.
If you have unreasonable demands on life, you're like a bird that's trying to destroy himself by bashing his wings on the edge of the cage, and you really can't get out of the cage. It's stupid. You want to have reasonable expectations and take life's results, good and bad, as they happen, with a certain amount of stoicism.
You can have all the riches in the world, but if you lead a life where you are absolutely miserable, you aren't going to enjoy the success you garner. Charlie was a very big believer in the idea of keeping expectations simple and surrounding yourself with good people. If you notice you are reaching success in your life but feel drained or unhappy, it may be time to look deeper into what the reason is. Are you surrounding yourself with unhappy people? Are your expectations of yourself so high they are impossible to reach? By being able to be kind with yourself and allowing the right people into your life, it will allow you to transform into a happier and better person. Lesson number two, treat success and failure the same.
Treat those two imposters, success and failure, just the same. I mean, why not take these opportunities, these hardships and so forth, to make a man of yourself? And so, I know how you should cope with whatever the difficulties are of the present day. Just keep your head down and do your best and do that. Some of the people who had the best careers in my age cohort or the age cohort just before mine were the ones who had the worst clobbering in the 30s, because they were there when the great boom came. If you just kept plugging, why, the favorable tide came in due course.
Charlie is part of the reason Berkshire Hathaway has become the industry-known giant that it is today. He explained many times that he looks at success similar to failure, and by doing this, he was able to keep on the path that led him and the entire company to success. Remember, take the teachings that the hardships and the successes are teaching you and apply them to your future endeavors. By doing this, you guarantee either a success won or a lesson learned. Lesson number three, have good judgment.
If you have good judgment, your life will work a lot better than if you have bad judgment. And you get good judgment gradually over time, partly by making bad judgments and having them work out poorly. So my counsel has always been to start trying to be better and keep trying to improve all your life, and you got about half a chance. If you don't do that, you got like no chance. I used to say I can only teach what the other person almost knows. Then I can just throw him over the brink when he's hanging on the edge. But if the guy is not within miles of even starting, I never make any public. I never succeed.
When starting to make big decisions, it can be daunting and seemingly impossible. Without making mistakes and learning from them, you can never learn to have good judgment. Charlie explained how important it is to make bad decisions first because it helps grow your understanding of what a good decision is. Without the bad dates, the low test scores, or the bad investment choices, you would never learn the difference between a good call and a bad one. Trust yourself enough to make the mistakes and learn from them so in the future, you can apply what you've learned to become better. Lesson 4. Soldier on.
I basically believe in the soldier on system. Lots of hardship will come, and a few rare opportunities will come. You've got to learn how to recognize them when they come and not make too minor a trip to the counter when the opportunity is available. And those are simple lessons.
Life is never going to be easy. And one thing Charlie knew well was the importance of being able to take the good with the bad and to keep going even when it felt like the world was against you. He constantly advocated for people to keep their heads up in hard times and to remember that tough times don't last forever, but tough people do. If you are to make it in the real world, financial or otherwise, staying the course when the going gets tough is a trait that will help you become successful.
It's so simple. You don't have a lot of envy, you don't have a lot of resentment, you don't overspend your income, you stay cheerful in spite of your troubles, you deal with reliable people, and you do what you're supposed to do. And all these simple rules work so well to make your life better, and they're so trite. I could tell that some of my older people were a little bonkers. I've always been able to recognize when other people were a little bonkers. And it helped me because there's so much irrationality in the world, and I've been thinking about it for a long time. Its causes and its preventions and so forth. Sure, it's helped me. And staying cheerful because it's the wise thing to do. Is that so hard?
What are you doing on your phone all day? There's probably something within there that's a billion-dollar opportunity. The crazy part about business, you only need one hit. That's it. Zuckerberg, Warren Buffett, all these people really just did one thing. But I've worked directly for Zuckerberg, Dustin Moskovitz, Matt Kohler, these are all billionaires. Sean Parker, been around Peter Thiel a little bit. I think the two biggest kind of surprises, two or three of them, one, they didn't set out to become a billionaire. They just really cared about a problem. Now, the second part of that, most of them didn't get to become a billionaire or super rich for 20 years. And recognizing that and being like, okay, cool. If I can be patient and focus on longevity, I can become a millionaire, multimillionaire, maybe billionaire or beyond. Things that's common, especially for employees, is thinking that they can't escape being an employee. You know, it does take time, patience, and belief, dream, fantasy. And through that you can create the reality. I've done a lot of things, man. I've been swinging for a long time, and that's something that's available to everyone. And I do think that's missed out on, that there's a lot of ordinary people being rich and being successful, and people think it's an exclusive club. And that's just not true. I tried 24 different businesses to finally get to AppSumo, to finally eventually get rich. Think about in your own life and your own businesses, like, what is the thing you're looking forward to and excited about? And it could even be small. Like, one of my phrases I like is put it on the calendar. What's on the calendar? What are you looking forward to? Of what you're excited about? And then the reality is that you can actually get going towards that dream sooner than you realize. Everyone should be an entrepreneur, everyone, because if you get fired today, what's your backup plan? Go on Indeed.com and pray. Like, having an entrepreneurship where you can have your own business, and if you start it right now, not how, you just get started. And that, a lot of what we cover, that is exactly $1 million weekend. You could do it in a weekend, which everyone has. They can change their life in 48 hours. You have the option. I know a lot of people, let's take AppSumo.com. We have a lot of people who have very successful side businesses and they're happy with their day jobs, and that's great. But I think people don't swing enough. They don't even get started swinging, and that's, you know, they're not ready on the sidelines. And there's never a good time. The best time is right now. It's not yesterday because that passed. It's not tomorrow because you don't know. It's right now. There's 3,100 billionaires on the planet, which is not that many. So if you want to meet one and learn from one, that's a really great cheat code of life. And they're accessible. And so taking a step back around interviewing billionaires on our YouTube channel, and then myself running almost $100 million a year business at AppSumo.com, it's the power of asking is the most powerful thing that no one is really improving on or really getting started on. And that's available. There's no exclusivity on it. The upside of asking is unlimited, and the downside is a moment of discomfort. The second thing with this YouTube channel from interviewing billionaires and millionaires is that there's so many different ways of getting rich. I thought that everyone else you can only get rich on the computer and on these worldwide webs. I didn't know how to do it, but I thought that was the only way. And so through the YouTube channel, it's been so powerful and so special. There's Larry Janeski. He's making $600 million a year on basements. You have this lady, Jan, which I guess it's kind of funny. Her name is Jan. She does jam. She got rich selling strawberries. There's Michael Hudner, who did ships. There's Rafa and James, who did energy trading. Right, there's such a phenomenal variety of people that are getting rich outside of just computers, and I think that's so exciting to think about. Hey, what is the area that I really like? Is it cooking? Is it doing landscaping? Is it computers? And the ability in that to create a lifestyle and a lot of money around areas that we're interested in. You hear all these, like, I'd say fake entrepreneurs or fake coaches. They don't actually have any real businesses. They're like, you got a 10x today, and you got a 5x. If you're not 5xing, you're failing. And I was like, I've done that, but it's also interesting. What if you, our goals now for AppSumo.com is to grow 10% next year, and it's been that for quite a lot of time. And the reality is when you set less ambitious goals for yourself, you can stick with them for longer because you're not burnt out, you're not tired. You can sustain. And then by having less ambitious goals, you also have creative freedom because you're not stressed about hitting a target. And that gives you the ability to create 10x opportunities because you're like, okay, cool, I'm not worried about making money in that, but I can go do things that potentially, you know, be moonshots and really drive the company for the future. There's a lot more smarter people out there than they give themselves credit for. The only difference is that I start. That's the biggest difference. But I would say the success of a founder and success in if you want to be an employee CEO within a company is, how are you being resourceful? How are you solving the goal and the problems and the priorities with the resources that are available? Most people sit and they complain like, oh, I don't have this. Like, there's a lot of people, I'm not getting paid enough. Well, what are you doing about it? Did you put together a proposal? Did you go look at comparison analysis? Did you go create more revenue so it's obvious that people should get pay you more? When you're going somewhere in a car, you're like, of course I want a destination. Then why don't we replicate that in business? If you look at all the best CEOs today, the ones that I admire, almost all of them are immigrants. You know, my father's an immigrant, didn't speak English, came to this country. Satya at Microsoft, name these companies. I mean, just most of them. The guy running Google, Sundar, a lot of the ones. I mean, even Elon Musk, who is debatably a great CEO, you know, South Africa. And so what is it with them that we can all learn from? And at AppSumo.com, we have Eamon from Iran, my father's from Israel, Alona's from Uzbekistan, Sean is from London, Vanessa's from Colombia. Like, you know, what is it about immigrants that we can all copy? Because that is what built America was, we all came here from somewhere else. And so the two things that have really struck with me, and I saw this woman who exemplified it, her name was Sharon. And she kicked so much, and she was working basically at the Best Western, serving breakfast. And I, you know, if you've never been to a Best Western, it should be called the OK Western, right? It sucks. But she was working like she was at, you know, the Four Seasons. I could not believe it. She's like bringing me pancakes. She's doing all these things. And she was acting like a founder and an immigrant. I would say she is an immigrant. And I asked her, I said, you know, tell me more what's really going on. She's like, there's two things. It's my attitude and it's my effort. Because that's in control, that you're totally in control of your attitude. And that's what I look for when I work with people and we hire people at AppSumo.com. And her effort. There's literally no restriction on effort. There's no law. The only law is 24 hours.
Poverty is a state of being. Everybody wants income and influence, but we don't want to impact. In order to see income and influence, I've got to impact. The poverty that we experience is a symptom of something that has happened on the inside of us. These ideas, this way of living, was passed down to us. And so number one, you got to become aware that something's off on the inside of you. There is a rewire required in order to go to that next level in our finances. Most wealthy people started with an idea before they had the dollar. So my question for you today is, what's your idea? What's your calling? What's your product? How can we eat from the economy and not contribute to the economy? Wealth not coming to you. Wealth comes from you. As you contribute to economy, as you drive humanity forward, you get rewarded based upon your contribution. Everybody you know that's wealthy is investing and creating. One of the chief problems with poor people is that they don't want to contribute, and they trade time for money. And the only thing that they contribute is enough to get a check. And so that's why when they get the check, they spend the check on entertainment. They spend the check on stuff that's not going to make them any money. Wealthy people turn their dollars into soldiers. They put their money to work. They invest in systems. They invest in programs. They invest in real estate. They invest in opportunities that will make them more money. Poor people get paid. They live check to check, and they spend that money on entertainment because they want to break from working for the 9-to-5. So they have a budget for entertainment, but they have no budget for education. Occupy, occupy. Take up your space. Turn the city upside down. impact lives. From the person on the elevator in the parking lot to the stages of destiny, you have a calling. Once you identify it, all of a sudden, everything begins to change. Jeff Bezos said, you can have a job, you can have a career, or you can have a calling. And he says, if you can find that calling, bam, everything begins to change. You can make $100,000 a year and still have a poor mentality and spend all your money on entertainment. And so payday isn't really payday, it's transfer day, because you're just getting paid and you're giving it to the bill collector and you're not investing in anything that's going to make you money. You're not investing in stocks. You're not investing in real estate. You're not launching a product. You're not adding value to the marketplace. Wealthy people are invested people. Wealthy people are adding value to the marketplace to drive humanity forward. I got to put something out from Jeff Bezos to Mark Zuckerberg to Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, LeBron James, every athlete, every producer, every filmmaker, every musician, every singer. The list goes on. They are contributing something to humanity. They are a part of the driving force of the economy. What I need you to realize today is that money, zip codes, area codes, cars, and clothes is not the only evidence of wealth. You can change your mindset, your mentality, your methodology, shift your habits right now and experience a measure of abundance and wealth. And so break out of this scarcity mindset that it's too hard, that I don't have enough. Identify what mindsets and programs are keeping you broke and broken. How will you personally drive humanity forward in the coming years of your life? What are the consequences that you will have to pay if you stay where you are? Let me ask you a better question. Where has your operating system, the way that you function, the way that you move, the way that you think, the way that you respond, where has it gotten you? If you are listening to me and you are not where you are supposed to be financially, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, then what you have done thus far has not served you. And if it has, it has brought you as far as you're going to go. What will you create? What will you step into? How will you collaborate? What can you pioneer? How can you blaze a trail, a legacy of a wealth mentality?
The world does not belong to the pessimists, believe me. You're selling happiness, and it's, you know, and having it an arm's length away is a big part of it. And you know, the distribution system development, it's the right formula, Mutar, and it just has to be carried out with extreme diligence, enthusiasm, and every minute of the day.
There's an emotional undercurrent in Buffett's journey that we often overlook. One of the most profound lessons from Warren Buffett's life is that he doesn't just acquire businesses. He acquires the stories and experiences that come with them.
I would like to just tell you a couple of short stories, and we'll draw maybe a couple of lessons from them. Two women each sold a business to Berkshire Hathaway, to me actually, for many, many, many millions of dollars. Both of them started with $2,500. And one of them was a woman who landed in Seattle in 1917, couldn't speak a word of English. She felt like a dummy. She couldn't pick up the language. She couldn't learn a word. So they came to Omaha in 1919. And then as her oldest daughter went to school, she would come home, this daughter, Frances, and she would teach her mother the words she learned in school that day. And this woman, Rose Blumkin, spent 20 years saving money, bringing first her siblings over, her mother and father, $50 at a time. She sold used clothing to do it. She had four children during this period. And by 1937, after 20 years, she'd saved $2,500. She went to Chicago, and she bought what she could of furniture. Her dream had always been to open a furniture store. But with the same spirit that the people in this room had about having a dream and working to accomplish that dream, she built a business, which she sold to me in 1983 for $60 million approximately, and which did $1.5 billion worth of business last year. The fourth generation is working in that business. This woman, Rose Blumkin, she worked for me until she was 103. Then she retired and she died the next year, which is a lesson to all of Berkshire's managers that premature retirement, you know, not, you can't tell what's going to happen. But Mrs. B, with her $2,500, one further fact about her, she could not read or write. And she didn't bring anything in unique in furniture, but she brought a determination to succeed. And I saw one other woman who did a similar thing with $2,500. I paid her hundreds of millions of dollars for her business. Today, I'd like to tell you about one other small business person. This person, I went to buy his business from him, and he turned me down, which was very wise. But this was a fellow who was born about 8 years before I was. He was born in 1922. He was a pretty good athlete, didn't like school much. And I'm going to tell you one thing early in the story. Maybe you can figure out who the guy was. The company he built hires more college graduates each year than any other company in the United States. And this fellow, who was destined for this but did not know it, Jack, went to college for a year and then dropped out. He really wasn't that interested in school. And the year he dropped out was 1941. And when the country became, the United States became under attack, he went down to the Army Air Force recruiting station, volunteered. And then he came back to the Midwest. So now we've got a young guy. Probably by this time he would be 23 or 24 years old. And he actually kind of went from one job to another for a short period of, or not such a short period of time. And he finally became a used car salesman at a Cadillac dealership in St. Louis, Missouri. And at age 35, having moved up in the organization, the sales organization, he said to his boss, could I go into the car leasing business with you? The boss said, well, if you'll cut your salary in half and you'll come up with, I think it was $25,000, which he borrowed, we can become partners in a car leasing company. So my friend Jack started at age 35 in the car leasing business. And he had seven cars. It was pretty slow. In fact, one of the things he did was whenever the phone rang, he let it ring three or four times so people would think that he was very busy answering other phones. And of course, it was the only call he was going to get all day. So his first venture was okay, but it wasn't really going to go anyplace. And there's a lesson in this for all of us. At age 40, he decided with 17 vehicles, 17 cars, he was going to go into competition in the rental car. And he's got 17 cars, and his cars aren't any different than theirs. I mean, he's buying them from General Motors or Ford or Chrysler. And he can't get the airport locations. Those companies have them all sold up. But he was determined that he would basically offer the customer, can't offer him a different car, but he can offer him friendlier service than they've ever seen. And so he started a company. He named it after the battleship that he'd flown from in the Pacific, which was the USS Enterprise. And he died about a year and a half ago. But when he died, his rent-a-car company, starting with those 17 cars, was worth more than Hertz and Avis and all the rest of the rental cars put together. The man's name was Jack Taylor, and his son, Andy Taylor, is a good friend of mine, runs the business now. A grandchild is in the business. There'll probably be a fourth generation along the line. So this man in the United States, he didn't invent artificial intelligence. You know, he didn't do anything that, just like Mrs. B, selling furniture, I mean, that any one of us could have entered those businesses. But he lived by the creed, basically, of delighting his customers and working with people and establishing the relationship with them so that they in turn would want to delight the customers. He couldn't go out there and take care of every rental car possibility, but he learned how to project himself and his attitude toward his fellow man and his desire, you know, to make a friend out of every customer. He managed to take very ordinary cars and turn them into this extraordinary business from virtually nothing. But at the age of 40, with all of that experience behind him, he found the golden key, and he took a very ordinary business and turned it into an absolutely extraordinary operation. And just like Mrs. B, Rose Bumpkin did.
Rich is not just synonymous with money. Rich is synonymous with living. You know, when I think of money, all money really is energy. And it's ideally, it's energy in movement. And we don't circulate money particularly well in this world or in this country. It gets accumulated. And when things get accumulated, energy stops moving. So one way that we can begin to move money, as an example, is to have it become more meaningful to move it.
If you hoard your money, a few things happen. You get sick, and really? Then you have to pay for the medical bills.
Really?
Yeah, or like your kids do something bad, and then you have to pay for the damage. So money needs outlet. So it's so interesting how money flows. And if you don't let out money energy's outlet, it's gonna get bad. It's like a pond. Mm-hmm. If there's no flow, the water gets bad. And then the next flow comes in. So here comes money EQ, the trust part. Trust is the hardest part of money EQ. You have to have the trust that once you let go of money, it comes back. So you don't have the trust. That's why you start worrying. That's why you have doubts about yourself.
Life is about an expression of spirit. Life is an expression of itself. And it gets constrained by story. How can I be more artfully expressing who I am fully in a joyous way and accepting life as it comes to me without precondition? That gives me an opportunity to move beyond my story, and it also gives me an opportunity to really identify where my story is constraining me.
You have to find your place, your seat, your reserved seat is what I call. A lot of people try to sit on other people's seat, which is wrong because your seat is reserved somewhere else. And if you don't sit on other people's seat, what happens is that you get so depressed. And then you feel so meaningless, you know, so on all that. Because you cannot really feel life. But once you sit on your seat, you are so deeply connected with your life purpose, then you start, your magnetism starts, gets turned on.
For most people, what they do is exterior driven. It's driven by what we think others think we should have. It's not what we think we should have. And having a new iPhone, having a new watch, having an increased bank account may give me peripheral satisfaction, but deep emotional meaning is usually not going to be there. We have a poverty of meaning, particularly in the Western world, that is driven by rampant consumerism, thinking that we're going to replace this whole. And if people can stop and think about what's meaningful to them, You know, why am I alive? What can I be doing that will bring inherent meaning to who I am and why I'm here? That makes a big difference.
The first thing I would teach is money is fun.
Mm.
So if your kids know that money is fun, so we used to sit on the dinner table, just say, I have this, say, $10,000 to donate. What do you want to do? You can, you know, help rescue the animals. You can help the environment. You can help the homeless people. What do you want to do? And when we give presents, what would you want to do? So my daughter grew up thinking money can do so many wonders. So if all our kids learned money is a magical wand to make people happy, I think people are more excited about getting the money. So they have no negative ideas about money. Imagine what if all the child have never been scolded for wasting their money. I think we'll be so stress-free, because a lot of worries come from the need for survival, and it's attached to money.
Right.
So once we are free of money stress, I think our life will be so different.
Yes.
Yeah. So if you can teach money is a fun thing, that is a great starter.
Okay. Number one, teach them money is fun.
Right. And also, even though your child is grown up with a positive attitudes, your friends may not. So they're trying to compete with you of how much they have, allowances, or like, this is my new iPhone something.
Yes.
Or like, this is my sneakers, yeah, or whatever that is. And then people try to manipulate you,
yeah,
with emotions.